Back Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here on a Saturday afternoon. Beautiful Saturday afternoon. I think there is two lanes of traffic open in the entire metro area. I think I was rerouted about 2 hours out of the way here to get here today, but have to love the season of summer, fall, road construction. Construction, it made me think of a story I caught this week in the news, and we've actually covered the story here before, and I want to play some audio from this, and then I want to read you a news story. This is from CARE TV in 1987. The story was called Out on a Limb. It was a treehouse that someone had constructed, built beyond anyone's idea of what a treehouse would be, which I think most people believe some old paneling and 2x4s nailed up to a tree. But this story attracted national attention. This was from 1987, 28 years ago, and I want to play this right now.
House, and because of its size, the owner says he's getting a raw deal. Kevin McDowell reports.
Mark Tucker beams with a sense of accomplishment. He built this 6-level treehouse. It's the only thing he's ever built, and he didn't intend for it to be so sophisticated, but once he started pounding away, he couldn't stop. That was about a year ago. But just the other day, his children's retreat turned into a boiling controversy. He was told by the St. Louis Park City Council that he has to bring the treehouse up to housing codes or remove it.
Well, I'm obviously very angered at it. My children are very upset. It's affecting them emotionally. They've seen the number of hours that I've put into this project for them, and they know the love and concern that I've shown them by doing this for them.
Matt watched his father build a treehouse. He says it may be bigger than most, but it's safe.
It's not fair to us or anybody because no one has gotten hurt up here. In many other treehouses, I'm sure people would be able to be hurt a lot easier because most treehouses don't have railings.
The controversy has attracted nationwide attention. The Wall Street Journal, People Magazine, and the BBC have done or are doing stories on it. And while the attention is fun, Mark is still upset. He says he will not remove the $7,000 treehouse, and he can't afford an engineer to certify that it's safe. So Mark says he's headed for court. Kevin McDowell, News 11.
It's certainly beautiful.
It's great.
And there you go. The infamous St. Louis Park treehouse. So I found a story here in the news feed this week, and this is from Bring Me the News. An iconic 7-story treehouse in the backyard of a home in St. Louis Park is being taken down after standing for almost 30 years. Homeowner Mark Tucker decided it was too much to keep the massive structure he had built with his own hands up to code, and so has been instructed by city officials to take it down by the end of the year, the Star Tribune posts. Fox 9 reports it has been a popular landmark for 3 decades with people coming from across the state to take a look at the building, which has 7 levels of rooms and balconies wrapped up around a large maple tree. But for everyone who appreciated the architectural marvel to the rear of Tucker's home on Minnetonka Boulevard, there have been others who were less happy with the interest and subsequent traffic it generated, the TV station notes. The structure was a source of much controversy when Tucker put his job as an insurance salesman on hold to build the treehouse as a way of making good on a long-made promise to his teenage son with whom he had fallen out. The New York Times reported back in 1987 that issues with the cause prompting a legal battle with the city building inspectors who said the treehouse violated zoning codes, was a danger to local neighborhood children, but it was a battle that Tucker won in 1988 as a judge agreed that he could keep the building if provided he complied with safety regulations. The spotlight it created had an unintended effect for Tucker when the building code violations were discovered at several rental properties he managed in Minneapolis, which eventually landed him with a 10-day sentence in the workhouse. Now 65 and with his children grown up, the Star Tribune reports Tucker felt it too much work to keep the treehouse in a satisfactory condition. It was decided to get realistic and begin the process of removing it, he told the paper. Fox 9 reports that only 2 levels of the treehouse remain and that Tucker hopes to finish the rest before the cold weather arrives. The last days of the St. Louis Park treehouse are there. If you want to drive by, take a look at it, you might be able to see 1 level of it left. It's quite impressive, and watching this as a young person, the story unfolding. You tell your parents, why didn't you build this massive treehouse? It probably cost thousands of dollars. I think the treehouses that we saw in the neighborhood, usually, again, were old carpet, plywood, and a bunch of nails sticking out of it. So I'm not sure what's safer, the Mark Tucker treehouse. It looks better than most decks and homes that I've seen. Or the one that the 10-year-olds make. Soon to tell. It'll be gone, unfortunately, but you can see this video at tcmedianow.com. I'll also post it to the KLBB website. Let's take a break. We have a guest today. Our guest is John Bream. He wrote a book called Dylan Disc by Disc. He is the Star Tribune music critic. Looking forward to learning about this book and learning more about the mystique of Bob Dylan. Let's take a break. We'll come back here on KLBB Flashback Twin Cities.
At TIAA CREP, our record sounds like a broken record. We got impressive results in 2013. And 2014? Same thing. We're like, hey, weren't we just here? Then 2015, boom, more impressive results. That's the kind of record you'd expect from a company that's created to serve and built to perform. Intelligent investing, powerful results. Visit TIAA.org. TIAA CREF Individual and Institutional Services, LLC. Investing involves risk.
Health insurance matters. It really does. Hello, this is Richard Lett, CEO with the Clare Group in Woodbury. Join us Saturday on the A to Z of Medicare, whether you are aging in, had Medicare for years, or interested in knowing more about this important program. You'll be joining industry experts discussing original Medicare, Advantage plans, Medicare supplements, and cost plans. The show is live, so plan to listen and call in your questions on the best options for you. This show is for educational purposes and will not discuss specific plans. Join us this Saturday, 2 p.m., live on KLBB.
You know what I like? A good spicy Irishman.
Ooh, and I love a strutting Tom.
Oh, what about Reuben or Rachel?
And how about that drunken Wilbur?
But you cannot forget about that stuffed Molly Malone, because those are just a few dishes at Pub 112 that are sure to snare the senses and subdue the appetite. And of course, after dinner, enjoy a nightcap at Molly Malone's Whiskey Lounge.
And of course, an Irish pub will have all your favorite beers on tap.
So here's to a long life.
And a merry one.
A quick death.
And an easy one.
A pretty girl.
And an honest one.
A cold beer.
And another one.
Pub 112 and Stillwater.
So what are you guys doing this weekend?
We're going to the Minnesota Renaissance Festival near Shakopee.
Really? Well, we've never been. Oh, it's awesome. They've got entertainment like live armored jousting, wandering street performers, music, hundreds of crafters.
Shopping.
And there's good food and drink and...
Shopping.
So we can go for the fun and stay for the...
Shopping. Right.
The Renaissance Festival continues weekends to October 4th. Discount tickets available online and at Super America, Menards, Walgreens, and Whole Foods. For more information, visit renaissancefest.com.
Tom Osmond here. Our guest is on his way. He's stuck in traffic. So let's play some Bob Dylan, shall we? We'll get kind of in a Bob Dylan mode here before John comes in. This is Bob Dylan. We'll play some music and we'll come back with our guest as soon as he arrives.
Well, it ain't no use sitting and wonder why, baby. Even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby. It'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on. But don't think twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in the turning on your light, babe. The light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. Don't think twice, it's all right. So it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I'm told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right. So long, honey dear, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind, you could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. Don't think twice, it's all right.
When you Club 1220 KLBB presents the Community Calendar. The American Red Cross is holding blood drives this afternoon at Kowalski's Market in White Bear Lake and at Culver's Restaurant in Stillwater. A fundraiser for YMCA camps in western Wisconsin is being held today at YMCA Camp St. Croix in Hudson. The Prairie Burn Music Festival runs until 10. The Spirit of the St. Croix Arts Festival is going on today and Sunday in Hudson's Lakefront Park. New Richmond's annual Heritage Weekend is today and Sunday, and the 37th annual Afton Art in the Park is taking place today and Sunday in the Afton Village Park. St. Joseph of the Lakes Catholic Church in Lionel Lakes is hosting a banquet dinner for the American Wheelchair Mission tonight at 6 at the Church Social Hall. Call the church at 651-784-3015 for tickets. And that's the Community Calendar.
Ready to take a voyage through the sounds and styles of some of the world's greatest musical performers? Hey, I'm Mike Martin, host of Martini Mix, and every week I bring you timeless greats of music. Artists like Count Basie, Frank Sinatra, and Tony Bennett, plus new artists like Sophie Millman, Tony Desair, and Michael Bublé. I'll bring you the perfect blend of music, nice and cool, served straight up on Martini Mix with Mike Martin.
Join us for Martini Mix at its new time, 6 o'clock on Saturday night on Club 1220 KLBB.
Since 1981, West Wind Supper Club in River Falls, Wisconsin has become known as the area's go-to restaurant for excellent service, the very best entertainment, and consistently delicious food, all at a reasonable price. Visit thewestwind.com today and preview their current menu, live music schedule, and learn more about catering services. And don't forget to like them on Facebook so that you'll always be the first to know about daily events and specials at West Wind. West Wind Supper Club, just off North Main Street in River Falls, Wisconsin. Learn more at thewestwind.com.
Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osman here with our guest, John Bream. John, welcome to Flashback Twin Cities.
Thanks. Good to be here, Tom.
Robert Zimmerman. Now, most people in this audience probably know what that name means. The mystique, the mystery Bob Dylan, disc by disc. This book, I was fortunate enough to go to an event at the Parkway Theater about 2 weeks ago with a Bob Dylan panel, a packed theater, by the way, on a Thursday night with a threat of rain. I was surprised, not because people wouldn't come out to this kind of event, but it was packed. And there's people with a lot of questions to you in this panel on Bob Dylan. Is the attention that this man gets, the attention, the mystery behind him, is that what drove this book project, being able to analyze his music and take a panel of 45 Bob Dylan experts?
Well, it's not a question. The premise wasn't about the mystery. The premise was that people don't agree on Bob Dylan. You know, they debate Bob Dylan. Some people think, you know, he's the voice of a generation. Some people think he's a voice you can't listen to. So the idea was to get two different commentators talking about each of his studio albums with me moderating the discussion.
And disc by disc, going all the way from the early 1960s to contemporary day. How many years in this project was in the making? When did you start thinking about this idea?
I was approached in fall of 2013 about the project. They actually wanted me to write essays about each of the albums. And I said, well, I'm somewhat well known in Minnesota, but I don't know if this would sell outside of the area. So I like to think out of the box and came up with the idea of putting many voices instead of just one voice talking about Dylan's album. So the actual work on the book took about 9 months.
Mm-hmm. And your voices, your panel, how was that vetted? How did you decide who was going to be part of this project?
What I wanted to do, Tom, was get critics, professors who teach classes on Bob Dylan, and musicians who are interested in Bob Dylan and fans of Bob Dylan. So I recruited people from all over the country, insisted that they all be in the United States because the conversations were done via conference calls, so it would have been too difficult to hook up people from Europe, say.
And what did you find anything surprising? These are people you, I'm sure, had worked with before, people you've been there.
Well, actually, there's 55 commentators for 72 slots, so some people did more than one album. I would say of the 55, I only knew 22 or 23 of them. So a lot of them were just complete cold calls.
As someone who's studied Dylan, you've interviewed Dylan and you know Dylan.
We hang out together all the time.
I assume so. Also, I like when and I've noticed this at the Parkway Theater, one thing that I don't care for as a host sometimes, and when people say, well, what are they like? You go for an interview with someone for a few minutes, and then you're supposed to channel their personality and what they are and what they eat and what they drink and what they do and what they're thinking about this. And what I like about the book is it's talking about the music. It's talking about the music. It's a critical approach to the product he's producing. And like, to, again, when I say the word mystery, I think that people, and much like Prince also, when they don't lay it all out there, they don't do a lot of interviews, they don't open themselves up, people have a higher interest. Sometimes the music itself gets lost in the actual persona of the artist.
Well, certainly Dylan, like Prince, has fueled the mystique by not doing interviews, by being mysterious, by making up stories about their background, that sort of thing, and just not letting you in. You know, the music will speak for itself. But there's a difference between interviewing Bob Dylan and talking and hanging out with Bob Dylan. Because when you interview him, he's in interview mode, and it's, I wouldn't say confrontational, but he's the kind of guy who you ask a question, he'll answer with a question, and he is often not very revealing. But if you put away the tape recorder and just hang out with him, it's like talking to a normal Minnesotan. Hey, what's going on? What's up?
You mentioned a story at the panel. You were in the limo with him, and he gave you his tape to listen to and put you on the spot. And the line you gave, and I'm paraphrasing here, was great. You find something in the track that to be positive about it, because you can't tell someone after you heard their work, their piece, to say, well, you know. But you said, I can't remember what the word was, but, well, this sounds good.
Well, I talked about it was the Knocked Out Loaded, and if you look in the back of the book, we have our commentators rated the albums, and of the 36 albums, that rates near the bottom. I think it's third from the bottom. And so I listened to a cassette, and we're riding in the van to the gig, and you have to react to it. I mean, he didn't say, what do you think? But so you talk about the one or two positive things you could say, like, I like, you know, this particular song that he wrote, Sam Shepard, and I like this Kris Kristofferson song. So, you know, it's like when you're a critic and you go to a concert, and right after the show everyone's hyped up and they happen to know who you are, so they come up and go, what do you think? Well, you don't want to burst their bubble, because they've just paid lots of good money and they're expecting to have a great time. So you have to make a positive comment, even if it's just, what an awesome light show.
No, and you know what? I'll tell you what, I saw, and I mentioned this before when I saw you the last time, first Bob Dylan concert I went to was at Roy Wilkins in 2004. And
I told you that was the worst Bob Dylan concert I've ever seen.
I finally had some money in my pocket where I could blow it on concerts. And I mean, this is the rock icon. This is Minnesota icon. I eventually got to go to the front row because people started flooding out. Mm-hmm. The hardcore Dylan fans, they were even leaving. Went down to the front row. Bob was having a good time. I think he might have had a good time that night. Or he was really exhausted because he was leaning on the microphone and muttering. I think I could maybe, you know, if I had more bravery to the show, I would start humming it. But I got to see Bob Dylan front row because everyone else spilled out. Year after, I saw him with Willie Nelson at Midway Stadium, one of the best concerts I've ever been to.
Mm-hmm.
He was on. Everything sounded great. And considering it's an outdoor concert without a lot of atmospheric challenges, it sounded great.
I mean, every show is different with Bob Dylan. You just never know. Even if he does the same set list you heard the night before, it's still going to have a different feel. It's, you know, in the moment, very in the moment. Same with his studio recordings. There's a new bootleg series, Volume 12, is coming out in November, and they leaked a couple copies of the press. I haven't gotten a copy, but I was reading some early reviews of it, and they talk about it's covering the years 65 and 66, which a lot of people will argue are his best years. And there'll be like four different versions of the same song and sound completely different. Different tempo, different instrumentation, different inflection on the vocals.
Bob Dylan, do you think that I've lived in Minnesota most of my life. I've did a few excursions up to the state. Is Bob Dylan as defended or popular outside of Minnesota, do you think, as he is in this state? Or do you think this is part, just being from Minnesota and Bob's from here, that he gets a little bit, we'll call it, I don't know, people who maybe wouldn't necessarily listen to this kind of music enjoy it, or do they defend it?
Well, he might get a little more love here because he's a Minnesotan. He's one of us. He still lives here part of the year. And I think we're proud of him. You know, when history will be written, I mean, he's certainly going to be one of the most famous Minnesotans, if not the most famous Minnesotan, at least to the rest of the world. And a lot of lot of people who don't live in Minnesota have no idea he's from Minnesota.
Right.
They really don't know his background or his roots. They probably think he's from New York or L.A. or wherever.
I want to bring it back to Prince for a moment, and I know that this is not something that, I'm not sure if you like that or not, but take Prince and Bob Dylan again. Both, I think that there's a lot of similarities both these artists from different generations. I think that, you know, personally, you know, Prince, you'll see Prince at the Metrodome. He'll be doing the Viking song. He uses Minneapolis references in his music still. Not so much Bob Dylan. And why do you think that is? And do you think, and I still think that Dylan maybe gets more acceptance from Minnesotans than Prince does still.
Well, Prince is a little bit more controversial. You know, his music, some of his lyrics were a little coarse for some people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not very mainstream. I mean, Dylan has always been, you know, to the left of center musically, mm-hmm. but there was nothing in there that was, offensive in a sexual connotation, whereas, you know, Prince has always been kind of hypersexual.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's the difference there. Prince lives here full time, pretty much, and so he's often referenced Minnesota in Minneapolis, and he's been proud of it, or even if it's uptown or whatever
right.
his pseudonym is for what he's talking about, or euphemism. Dylan has mentioned Minnesota a few times, but most of his songs are not very site specific.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah, there's Mozambique or an occasional song, you know, where you mention something. Duquesne Whistle, you know, has a reference to a certain spot. But he doesn't write necessarily about places as much as Prince seems to.
Which I find interesting because right now, downtown Minneapolis, we have a Bob Dylan
mural
going up.
Giant mural.
It's beautiful. And you had the
time perfectly to the release of the book.
Was this a coordinated event or was this coincidental?
We commissioned it. At a cost of nothing. No, it's total coincidental.
Well, it's fantastic. And from downtown Minneapolis, there's a lot of walls of decaying paint and peeling that is going to be much, much needed, much welcome. And it's a beautiful mural. The question I have, though...
And it works perfectly because when you're driving on Hennepin there in 5th, you get stuck in traffic, so gives you something to look at besides your cell phone.
No, right, exactly. And then that way, maybe at least you won't bump in the car ahead of you. My question is, do you think Prince will ever get that kind of recognition in Minneapolis? Now, again, as you said, Prince is from here, lives here, proud of it. But in Minneapolis, we're painting murals to Bob Dylan, and I don't think Prince is going to get the same love.
Well, as you pointed out earlier, Tom, different generations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob Dylan's in the autumn of his career. Mm-hmm. He's still active. He's 74. He still tours 100 shows a year. He released an album this year. Prince is active too. He's a little sporadic
mm-hmm.
because you never know how many shows he's going to do. But I think in time, Prince will receive that kind of love from the Twin Cities. I don't know if we're going to get a Sid Hartman like statue outside First Avenue or, a mural to Prince. But I would think he will be honored in some way, if only because you have a purple microphone there. So, you know, everyone honors him in their own subtle ways.
I think purple is going to be trademarked to Prince, I think.
No, I think the Vikings had it first.
Oh, you got a good point. Well, that's why he's a big Vikings fan. There's been a lot of Bob Dylan books. You go to the Half Price Bookstore, you go to Barnes & Noble, there's a lot of Dylan books. What are you going to get as a reader? What do you get out of the John Bream disc by disc that separates itself from the other Dylan books that are out there, even on his music?
Well, the idea was to create something that was novel and different that you couldn't find anywhere else. Most of the Dylan books are, you know, either historical or try to be erudite and analyze them from a scholarly standpoint. And they're all written from one voice, one person. So what we did, Tom, was we got 55 different voices in here and giving you their ideas of Dylan, and they don't all agree when we get together and have the discussions. And some of them are pretty lively, some of them are contentious, and I think they're all entertaining and enlightening, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. No, they are good, and it's one of those books, and by the way, the photographs are beautiful. The commentary between the... I'm sorry, 55. How many critics now? Because 45, we actually went to...
No, there's 55 commentators. There are 72 slots. Okay, so 36 studio albums, 36 times 2 gives you 72, and 55 different people, and me.
There's a lot of perspective, and your perspective. Did you try to get Bob Dylan to interview for the book? Did you
don't. No, didn't even try for Jacob Dylan either.
No. And I'm guessing he wouldn't do it if you tried, even if he tried.
But he has seen the book. I heard from a third party in between who is working on another book, and the photographer he was working with is working with Dylan on, Dylan is putting together a tour book program for his upcoming tour. And Dylan was talking to this photographer and said, well, I know which photos I want to use. And he said, well, which ones? He said, well, in the Bream book. And he started numbering off the pages of the photos he wanted included.
That's great.
So he's apparently seen the book.
And he does live in Minnesota still. I think that's sometimes people are debate if he actually lives in Minnesota still. I hear he goes to a donut shop up in Hibbing when he's up there. Or, I'm sorry, it's actually in, he lives in southern Minnesota, right? Or
no, he lives outside the Twin Cities.
Okay.
Near the Crow River,
okay,
sort of in the Buffalo area. That's where his nephews went to school. I received an email the other day from someone who said he pulled up in an RV in St. Michael, Minnesota for the 4th of July fireworks celebration. And he got out when it was time for the fireworks. He got out and sat in a lawn chair and watched them.
Well, celebrate 4th of July with Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I did not hear if he was wearing sunglasses or not.
You were mentioning the first time you interviewed Dylan. Were you at the Reader or were you the Star Tribune? Or say the Star?
I was at the Minneapolis Star.
And this is, and I'm not trying to date you here, but this was a music of your generation, Bob Dylan. I'm guessing Bob Dylan, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, this was music of your generation.
Mm-hmm.
And as a critic, I'm guessing you're trying to be objective, but you're sitting with one of the biggest superstars in the world, Bob Dylan right there, a person who rarely gives interviews, especially in this era, in the mid-70s, late 70s. He was giving very, very few interviews. Did you have a question that you'd been meaning to ask him, or are you asking him questions strictly to the concert or to the album at hand?
Well, the premise was talking about Ronaldo and Clara, his movie. So I went out there and we talked about the movie a lot. But I asked, one of the questions I asked was, what does Minnesota mean to you? And he just said, it's the earth, it's the land, or something like that. So, you know, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask, because everyone was curious, you know, what his attachment to Minnesota is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, we all know he's from Hibbing,
mm-hmm,
but does it really matter to him or not? And we didn't really have a sense of that, but clearly he feels connected to Minnesota and rooted here.
Yeah, there was, and learning some of the, at your panel, there's a Bob Dylan, is it Bob Dylan music appreciation course or a course on Bob Dylan? What the course was, it's a college course at the University of Minnesota. Is it Bob Dylan's music that's being critiqued? I don't remember what the actual course content was.
I think it's just an overview of Bob Dylan's career.
Okay.
Alex Lubet, one of the professors, was on our panel, and he's also on two of the albums in the book.
That's a long semester of Bob Dylan. I'm guessing you get a... Yeah, is this required reading for the course, I hope?
I don't know. The book just came out, and I don't think Alex is teaching it this fall. I think he's teaching it next spring. So it you know, has textbook possibilities, we hope.
Ironically, a man who left the University of Minnesota after a few weeks has a course now, and I think he has an honorary degree from U of M, too, I think. And now he's...
Well, Alex was explaining that the university asked him to write up a pitch to give a doctorate to Bob Dylan, and they reached out to Dylan, but never responded.
Hmm.
What a surprise.
Yeah, you think that he'd be giving a guest lecture in that course. I want to talk a little bit also about something that's near and dear to my heart. As a videotape person who has two levels of a house full of videotape and film. When the Star Tribune moved from 425 Portland some months back, there was a 25,000 vinyl record collection that you were, part of it was from your personal collection that you'd had, people had sent you promotional copies, you had reviewed them, and they were sitting in this basement, and the pictures of the basement of the Star Tribune where these records were housed was amazing. For a audiophile or one that loves records, it is amazing. These records were, you sold them, and they're now part of a scholarship for arts criticism, correct?
We took the money that we received from the sale of the vinyl and the CDs, and we're creating the John Bream Scholarship for Arts Criticism at the University of Minnesota, and there will be an annual recipient, and I will mentor the recipient for that school year.
That's fantastic. This is a great thing. Even though I'm guessing that had it been a little bit hard to see that collection go away, not be able to have access to that.
Yes, it's difficult. I kept a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I didn't get rid of everything I had. So I kept the Dylan and the Prince and a few other things. It's difficult, but you know, you can't you can't consume it all. It should belong to other people and have other people have the opportunity to have it. I mean, I thought of donating to a library, and I think this became a better solution because you can get into a lot of red tape with a library.
Right. When you went through this collection, I'm guessing it's what you did. You catalog it yourself, or was it already cataloged? One issue I always have with my collections is, what do I have and where do I put it? And I was reading in the current blog they did on this particular story that you said you had a system. There's ones that came from out of town, ones that were local. That's my system too. I'm not sure if I have a good catalog library management system to it. But were you able, before this collection has gone away, to find where that first issue, that first Prince album was, to be able to go down to that stash and find it? Or was that a peck and hunt mystery afterward?
That one was already pulled out. That didn't even make it to that library. That stayed at home. But I did have a system. I sorted them out, sorted them by genre. So the country records were together, the jazz records were together, the R&B and disco records were together, the rock and pop records were together, and that sort of thing. And then they were alphabetized within those genres at one point, and then we moved it from my house. It occupied the entire walkout basement, or about one-third of the house. We moved it down to the Star Tribune with three St. Thomas students and myself. And then the Star Tribune moved it, I think, three times without warning. They would tell me after the fact. They tried to keep things in boxes and numbered, but it kind of got messed up a little bit.
Now, did the Star Tribune or yourself do... When I find tapes, I find that people do two things which I would tell them not to do. Put it in the hot attic, the garage, or the leaky basement. So I'm hoping the Star Tribune put these in a cool, dry spot so that...
It was cool, not necessarily dry, but it was off the floor.
Okay. A lot of record collections, in 1987, I get a lot of people tell me that any film or good records they had were destroyed in the Dinah flood back in 87. There was a KQRS program director I had in here one time who had 15 years of promotional albums and first issue discs, gold discs, came back from Europe after a flood, and they were all gone. And he brought them to half-price books and told them book records that would then worth $300 were worth about a buck now.
Wow.
Unfortunate. But
if you're impressed by my collection, I was just down in Nashville to do a panel on Dylan in Nashville at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I went and visited a friend of mine who's a journalist down there. You're sitting down, Tom. You ready? 300,000 pieces in his collection, including 45s. His grandmother had a record store. This fellow's in his late 60s, and it's all cataloged, except for the bios, because he said he hasn't had an assistant for the last 2 years, but it's all cataloged in his humidity-controlled basement. This guy was a librarian by trade before he became a journalist, and he's got so many things that the CDs... He gets rid of the jewel boxes and just keeps the front and back cover and the CD itself, and it keeps them in a little plastic sleeve.
The best part about that is, with 300,000, I did have to take a little gulp here, 300,000, he obviously knows when you want to find the Hanging Tough CD from New Kids on the Block, one of your favorite groups of all time, he can find that. He can find that disc.
Yeah, he has the right stuff. Yeah, no, and I mean, he showed me, and he had boxes of 45s that like hadn't been opened, you know, because they came from his grandmother's business or whatever.
When you were at the, and I guess today John Bream, the book is Dylan Disc by Disc, and we're going to go a little backwards here. We do in this show, we do a little bio here, so forgive me for putting in the spot a little bit here. You were at the Minnesota Daily, and was your goal to work in as a music critic, or was that your interest, or is that something that came to be because you're working, I understand you were selling records, you were doing some part-time work with the Star. How did the music critic role evolve?
Well, I actually worked in the news department and in sports, and at one point I was managing editor of the paper, and I had a falling out with the editor-in-chief, so I quit. And one of my friends who I'd worked with on the copy desk was the arts editor. He needed an assistant, so I became the assistant arts editor, and I realized, look at all these free albums we're getting. This is way cool. I was a music lover, and then I started thinking, you know, this might be a good way to get onto a major daily quickly. You know, a lot of our friends who were graduating and they were going to work in Rochester or Mankato or, you know, Morehead or Fargo, you know, some other smaller town. But I thought I could probably get onto the Star Tribune quickly. And sure enough, I started freelancing for them because they had, oh, the theater critic could cover, you know, James Taylor.
Right.
But they didn't want to cover Led Zeppelin.
Right, right.
Or the classical critic could, you know, cover Carole King, but they didn't want to cover, you know, the Rolling Stones. So I saw a need, an opportunity, and it was a faster track to get to the daily newspaper.
Well, the period of time, it was kind of the, what was called now classic rock, or, you know, this album, AOR Rock, at that time. Those were long, and granted, I'm a novice at this than you, but forgive me here for a second. It was that period when, you know, albums were made to be a experience. You talk about, you know, Pink Floyd, The Wall. These weren't albums you're going to be able to perform live at a concert. These are albums that were only made to be listening to on in your home stereo system, which were becoming more sophisticated at the time. So, again, I'm guessing that he had two papers, and there was not a lot of people that were covering his albums. These were kid stuff, or they were, it's a rock and roll thing that people didn't want to listen to. At least what the older generation at the time was buying papers was. And I'm guessing this was a good niche to get into, to be able to do this, go to concerts, go to junkets, and again, get some good albums.
Right, and there's the Bay City Rollers, too, for the kids.
That's right.
It wasn't all album rock. And there was lots of country, too.
I think they're at the casino next week, right? Bay City Rollers? Maybe not.
I don't think so.
Okay.
But you put in your request, maybe if you call in enough times, maybe they'll get back together.
I'm working on that. Do you recall the first concert you went to as a critic that you had to cover?
The first concert I covered as a critic when I was freelancing was Todd Rundgren at the St. Paul Civic Center Theater.
The ticket was probably $10, probably, to get into that face value?
It was 1974. It was probably less than $10.
And what was your, did you give a favorable review, or do you remember the review? Was it a good one? Was it a critical one?
I don't recall offhand. I could look it up. I have the clip in the basement now.
Okay.
But, I think it was probably favorable.
Yeah.
Although there were a few shows early on that I didn't like the artist. I think I described Kiss as headache music. First time I saw him, I didn't get it.
I'm guessing that was the first time that you had written a critical review. You're a young guy. You're writing a critical review, and there's these legions I know just from having some friends of mine that are very Prince protective. And when there's criticism of Prince, whether it be from mainstream critics or from the media, there's a lot of anguish, especially here in Minnesota. We're tightly defending Prince. Writing critical analysis of popular music, and then getting the letters back in those days, or the emails now, or the, you know, phone, leaving voicemails on your telling you don't know what you're talking about, and that, and I know you have a thick skin, because I was reading the City Pages blog. Was that challenging at first, to be told you're wrong, you don't know what you're talking about, even though it's from the masses?
To do this job, you have to have confidence in your opinion and a thick skin. If you don't, you won't last long. So, you know, you just kind of roll with it. You know, sometimes it's best not to respond instantly, maybe wait till the next day. But oftentimes when people call on the phone and you discuss it with them, they'll understand your opinion a little bit more. Sometimes it seems pretty black and white when it's printed in the paper or if you read it online. But if you actually have a discussion and a nuanced discussion, mm-hmm. they'll understand your point of view a little better.
You wrote a book on Prince, The Inside the Purple Rain, REIGN, when no one was writing a book on Prince. It was probably the first book on Prince that, gave some critical analysis to his career and what he was doing. From what I understand, that wasn't Prince's favorite book.
No. He didn't like it. I gave him an advance copy, and he threw it across the room and wasn't happy because Prince is a control freak, and it was something mm-hmm. he didn't have a control over. And so there were various parts of the book he objected to. Whether it was a picture of his purple house or, you know, something I said about him.
It has to be challenging for a person like Prince in the digital world to have all these. I know that from a digital point of view, YouTube was not built on copyrighted. People own copyrights. It was built on people either taking other songs and doing bootleg TV video, take your pick. But there was a story I pulled out a few weeks ago that a woman put a video of her child on YouTube, and in the background, a Prince song is playing on the radio. this got taken down by the Prince label on YouTube because you could faintly hear When Doves Cry in the background. I don't think Prince is a fan of this uncontrollable landscape of the digital media system.
No, he's not. But didn't I hear that got reversed and it was okay for her to do that?
It might have been. We played, of course, the story where it was taken down.
So right, and I know he, you know, his people reached out and you know took an effort to bring it down, but then I thought it got overruled, possibly.
I'll check into that. But
it reminds me of the book I did before. Bob Dylan was on Neil Diamond,
mm-hmm.
and so one of Neil Diamond's many entertainment lawyers contacted our publisher and said, well, there's a picture on page such and such of Neil standing in this office. Now, you have a right to the picture of Neil standing in the office, but you do not have the right to all those photos that are on the wall in the background.
Did you have to fuzz them out?
I think the lawyer for my publisher politely told him to take a hike.
You know, my question always is, well, how much money do you want to spend to take down this, you know, my material or whatever it is I'm doing? And it's just
it's a question. They have more. The entertainers have more money than the public. So it's intimidation, is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of control.
Mm-hmm. That book is Neil Diamond is Forever Illustrated Story as Man and His Music. Also, a whole lot of Zeppelin. One of my favorite books. That was
by the way, Tom, days. If you're a big Zeppelin fan, the second edition of the Zeppelin book is coming out in November. So we've updated it. Three new chapters to sort of tell you what happened since 2008 when that book first came out.
It comes in November of this year, correct?
Yes.
That is great. A whole lot of Zeppelin. A great book. If you're a Zeppelin fan as myself, check out A Whole Lot of Zeppelin. And I'll have to bring my copy because I have about... My book collection is not as vast as a record collection, but I was looking through four different bookshelves today to find that book because I read it about the week it came out, and now I'll have to bring it in for our next interview sometime or get it.
Okay.
I want to get that signed. Again, the book, Dylan Disc by Disc, this is available at all bookstores, Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
You can call me at the Star Tribune, and I'll sell it out of my trunk, my car.
And tell us something. If you like Bob Dylan, if you like his music, there's great pictures in here. Obviously, Bob wants these for his own personal collection. He wants to use these as his own promotion. If you don't want to read the text and you want to read the book, or if you want to look at the pictures, you want to just look at a few of the albums, it's a book you can pick up. You can kind of open the middle of it, start reading some of these analysis of 55 critics.
Yeah, you don't have to read it chronologically. I jokingly said to the editor when we were doing the book, I said, well, it's kind of a bathroom book. You could just pick it up and, you know, read one chapter. And there's actually a term for that in the book business. It's called a dip-in book,
mm-hmm.
where you can just dip in one chapter. It doesn't have to be in chronological order. You could start with chapter 31 and then go back to chapter 2.
If you're on the roads in the metro today and in traffic, I think there's two lanes open in the metro area today. Two lanes you actually can go at a regular speed at. The rest of them you're going to crawl for about, I don't know, an hour. You can take your Zeppelin book. You can kind of look over the pictures. You know, turn a page. Wait 5 minutes for your next hit on the gas. Go look at some more pictures. It's a great book. And again, A Whole Lot of Zeppelin. The second edition comes out in November. And again, you can read Neil Diamond is Forever, Illustrated Story, Man in His House, and His Music. You can check out your column in the Star Tribune, your work in the Star Tribune.
Yes.
Several times a week. At StarTribune.com. You can call John Bream, and he'll sell you a book out of his trunk. Thank you for being on today, John.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Dylan Disc by Disc, John Bream. This is Tom Osmond, Flashback Twin Cities. We'll be back next Saturday here on KLDD Club 1220.